Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la, sha-la-la. Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. The subject of tonight's program is Radio Labor Canada, an update. And with us, as before, a special guest, Mark Belanger, News Director and Labor Educator, Radio Labor Canada. Mark, thank you for being back here on the Labor Exchange at KGNU.
You're most welcome, and hello, Dennis.
Thank you, and hello to you. Mark, let's begin with some background. As before, what motivated, inspired you to create and be an integral part of Radio Labor Canada?
Actually, it was the motivation was straight out of the United States, because at the time that we started, which is about 10 years ago, in the United States, there were 40 radio stations that were carrying labor programs. And we thought we could do the same kind of thing for an international, like global audience. I know the name of the Radio Labor is sometimes attached to Canada, but I'm based in Canada, but the service is international. Unfortunately, over the past year or so, all of the radio stations that were carrying the labor programs stopped, because the two services that were supplying the programs lost their funding because of the loss of membership of their supply of their union sponsors and such. So it's a sad story, but that's how we got started, and we were helped by the American Labor Programs.
Mark, how has your impressive educational background contributed to your work at Radio Labor Canada? And with that said, could you share this education with this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members?
Well, I'm not sure it's very impressive, but thank you very much. What I have, I'm a labor educator. I have a PhD. It's called a multidisciplinary PhD, which means that you have to take a PhD in a number of subjects. In a normal PhD, you would do PhD-level work in one discipline. I have a PhD in communications, computer science, and labor education. The reason that I wanted to do a multidisciplinary PhD was that I did not want to stay inside the barriers, if I can put it that way, of labor education. I wanted to understand how the effects of communications, and especially computer science, was having on labor education. So Simon Fraser University in Canada has this unique program where if you can convince a committee that the topic you want to study falls between the cracks of the academic programs in existence, they will allow you to work with a committee to define your own study program. And that's what I did. So I studied communications, computer science, and labor education, and was granted a PhD. I've been able to apply that because, well, obviously, I work a lot with technology, so there's the computer science. The communication part is understanding what kind of issues and how to present them. And the labor education is quite unique, because there are not a lot of labor education PhDs in the world. So we're quite few.
That's great. You know, in fact, that answers part of the next question, the latter part. But anyway, I still want to ask this just to be simplistic, it might seem, but I think it's important. What is Labor, Radio Labor Canada, and its ongoing mission to reach all workers in Canada and throughout the world?
Well, I have to repeat this. Radio Labor is not Radio Labor Canada. I'm based in Canada, but Radio Labor is a global program. We are the radio service for the international labor movement, which means that we do our stories are of international importance. We very rarely cover Canadian stories. If something special happens, we'll cover it. But we produce daily programs about the international labor movement, 5 minutes every Monday to Thursday, and then a 15-minute program on Fridays. And almost all of it is international. And when I say international, by the way, I also mean that we do a lot of stories from the United States. We work very closely with the American Federation of Teachers, for instance, and some of their campaigns. So the process, the program is international, and that's the kind of audience that we have as well.
As before, and I want to talk about this because I just think that, I'll say it now right at the beginning, my opinion, this is fascinating. in its literacy programs. Could you detail how Radio Labor's broadcasts, audiocasts, etc. assist unionists studying English as an additional language? And with that said, how will or how has this helped thousands of unionists better participate in the international labor movement?
Well, to link into my last answer, we're an international service, and a lot of our listeners are people whose mother tongue is not English. They are using the service to listen to the reports in English, but at the same time, we have the scripts presented online. So they can read the script while I'm speaking or some of our other hosts or other reporters are speaking, and that enables them to better understand their English lessons. For instance, the major body that represents labor around the world, kind of like the AFL-CIO of the world, is called the International Trade Union Confederation, and it works with its acronym ITUC. Many people, when they're reading that, don't know how to pronounce the acronym. Is it ITUC? Is it ITUC or something? But if you hear somebody like me or you pronounce it on the radio, they get a better understanding of their lesson and what they're trying to learn. So in that way, it is quite a unique service.
Yes. And again, my opinion in terms of what you've done there is just fascinating. Mark, let's move into this, immigration migrant workers. Mark, desperate to live in peace, migrant refugees and their families from Central Asia, the Middle East, and Africa have been migrating into Europe and other countries of the world. How have countries like Germany, Sweden, your home country, Canada, dealt with new immigrant workers with success and positive outcomes?
This issue is so complicated, but I'll try to summarize a bit of our views about it. If this were 2014, we would be talking about the United States being the normal, generous nation that we have all learned to love, and a center of democracy and acceptance of migrants around the world. But in the past few years, that has quite seriously changed in the United States. One of the things that changed was that it used to be that when people came to the border between Mexico and the United States, they were seen as asylum seekers. Asylum seekers are people who are running away from war or starvation. And that's a factor because of the failing economies of many of the Central and South American countries. So when they get to the border of the United States, they are asylum seekers. They have been often called illegal immigrants. There's no such thing as an illegal immigrant seeking asylum. If you're trying to get into a country and you're at the border, you're an asylum seeker, you are part of the law. You are covered by the law, and it says you are allowed to have a certain amount of hearings and such. What happened in the United States a while back was that they changed the law from just addressing young men coming across to the many families that started coming because of the wars in Guatemala and all the rest of it. So suddenly you have families with a wife, a husband, children coming to the border, and so they changed the law and criminalized it. What that meant was that these people who were coming to the border for asylum to seek a better life were now told that they could not, and they were being criminalized by that. That is how they have been able to separate children from their parents. Because if the parents are charged with a criminal charge, then the law says they can separate the children. They couldn't do that before. So now you have an example of the greatest democracy in the world, the United States, has actually got children on the border kept in these detention centers that are atrocious in how they are treating children. The difference between how the United States is, and may I repeat, this is not the true soul of the United States. This is not the generosity of the Americans that we have known. This is a particular right-wing, libertarian, almost fascist regime that has taken over many of your legislatures and Congress. So things have changed in the United States. To compare to Germany, during the Syrian war, this is a war, Syrian war, people are fleeing from death. They Germany took in 1 million refugees. This is Germany in the middle of a continent with many other migrants trying to come in. They took in 1 million people. The United States took in 22,000. In this year alone, from January to April, which is the latest figures that I have, the United States took in 11 refugees from the Syrian war. This is not the America that we knew. And Canada, during the Syrian war, took in, let me remind you of the population difference here. In America, it's what, 360 million people. In Canada, it's 37 million people. In Canada, 300,000 Syrian refugees were taken in. At the same time, America took in 22,000. Something has changed in the soul of America, and we have to win it back. The generosity, the sense of democracy, the sense of kindness that has disappeared.
And with Germany, Sweden, and Canada, you know, again, all these Syrians and other immigrants have found work and are being a positive benefit to the country. And you've already, you know, my next question was, how's his contract with President United States Trump and his policy and everything? And you explained that real well. But, you know, for me, as before, and I was just talking to a couple of people who are volunteers, or, you know, work positions and that, you know, how the individuals that are seeking asylum, and it's, you know, there's corrupt governments and there's war, but there's also climate change. You know, some of their land's been ruined by, you know, long-time droughts. But here in the United States, I get a monthly email from the U.S. Department of Labor, and they just brag themselves up. But it's true. You know, we have like 7.2 million jobs that are available, but, you know, and for the most of them, there's a lot of them, there's more jobs than workers, and here they are at the border that, you know, a lot of them could fill those jobs. But I'm thinking, you know, we're not alone here, because I have this down here, and I believe you're aware of it because you do things on a global basis. But could you contrast this also with Hungary, Poland, and other countries with national populism leaders?
Well, I'm happy you raised this, because part of the problem with how America is handling the immigration crisis, that they want to call it a crisis, it's not a crisis. Migration levels from South America and Central America were falling. It's not a crisis. What's happened is that the right wing has taken on this topic to empower itself in other ways for other topics. It's scaring people, saying the immigrants are coming. I mean, what did Trump say when he first started his campaign? That they're rapists, they're criminals. Well, this is fear mongering. They do fear mongering so that they can win other policies. If they get elected because they scared everybody about the immigrants, well, then they can do other things, like, for instance, put in a conservative Supreme Court justice, you know, just because that they've now got power, because they were scared everybody about the immigrants. It's also happening in the countries that you mentioned. There's Poland and others. It's a worldwide phenomenon that the right wing is using these kind of anti-immigrant, anti-asylum arguments to win other arguments. And they're being helped by President Trump. He has legitimized this kind of talk, of this kind of attitude, this kind of policy making. And it's really quite scary.
Mark, let's move on to this. And I've asked this before, but it comes from one of your Radio Labor World reports from March 17th, 2017. It was 3 years ago, but I have quote unquote, because it's still relevant, 1 million migrant workers in UK fear being told to leave under Brexit. So as before, could you explain detail this potential disaster for these migrant workers, and how could a Brexit expand the situation?
This is another example of what I was just talking about. What's happened in the United Kingdom is that the very hard right wing, the Libertarians, the Conservative Party, that was more a center-right party. The Conservative Party was the party in power and still is. A center-right party has been taken over by a hard-right Libertarian faction. They've now put in their own prime minister. Boris Johnson is now part of that side of the Conservative Party. and they want to remove the United Kingdom from the European Union. That means that they would leave the European Union single market, where a lot of their goods. Now, remember where the United Kingdom is. It's an island right beside the rest of the European mainland. That's where they send their goods and bring in goods and their trucks going through the ferry systems and all of that. They are now saying that by October 31st, Halloween, that the United Kingdom will leave the European Union. The problem now is that they don't have a deal. They have not been able to negotiate a deal with the other European countries about how it all will happen. So one of the ramifications is what happens to all of the EU citizens who had the right to go to England and take jobs and work in the hospitals and work in the school boards. And now those people have no right to stay in the United Kingdom if it leaves the EU. That means there's up to 1 million people who could find themselves on November 1st with no legal right to be in the country. This is insanity.
That's good. Mark, we're going to continue to talk about it because this thing is ongoing, and it just, there's always, I listen to BBC World News that we broadcast here a number of times a day, and this situation is just incredibly difficult, and in terms of the deals and everything like that. But your concern and my concern are these workers. But let's move on to your travels. Thailand, Southeast Asia, Europe, International Labor Organization meetings. So with that said, Mark, within the past couple of months, you have traveled to Thailand, Southeast Asia. Could you talk about this trip in the context of workers making great efforts to form unions and expanding their goal for economic justice in this region of the world? And with that said, what did you learn from these workers and union leaders?
Well, as an international labor journalist, I get to travel to many conferences around the world. And one of them happened to be in Bangkok just a month or two ago. That particular conference was of a global union called Education International. EI is the acronym. EI has affiliates in education unions affiliated to it in many, many countries. And in the United States, for instance, it's the American Federation of Teachers and the NEA, the National Educators Association. So those unions that are part of Education International had their global congress in Bangkok, and I went to Bangkok after 15 hours on an airplane, by the way, which is not fun. But you have to do what you have to do to get the story. The global union had its congress and talked about major issues such as the privatization of education, and especially for the American Federation of Teachers, the fact that three years ago, 25 young teachers were killed in Mexico, in the southern part of Mexico, we think by the authorities, but the bodies have never been found, and nobody has ever been charged with it. And it's those kind of issues that are brought up. The other global unions are based on sectors, so that you will have a global union such as Industrial, which will take in the United Steelworkers and the auto workers. The Public Services International will take in unions such as public service unions across the world, such as AFSCME in the United States. I cover those kind of conferences. And then, of course, there are other conferences that happen with other workers. It's especially important to have these conferences because we are a very weak movement. We like to pretend that we have power and we exercise it as carefully as we can. And occasionally we have strikes like the 36,000 auto workers at GM are just now on strike.
Yeah, they were on strike at midnight last night. Yeah.
Yeah. So they hit the picket line. Nobody, I was a strike organizer for 10 years before I started some other stuff. And nobody wants a strike. Nobody, it hurts the families. It hurts the employer. It hurts the business. It hurts the workers. But then there are times you have to go out. What we don't have is a community that where unions can learn from each other around the world, except that the global unions are putting together as decently as they can, because they're not well-funded, programs, and they bring together these people in congresses. And as you know better than I, probably most of the work gets done in the hallway when you meet somebody from, I don't know, Afghanistan or Liberia or whatever. And that's where you get this melding of an international cohesion of labor power.
Mark, that's a good segue for this, and it's as per the previous question. Could you talk about and or explain, discuss your longtime activism with the International Labor Organization, or also known as ILO, or maybe I'm wrong here, maybe it's the ITUC, but it's based in Switzerland. So what kind of positive impacts has this organization had for all workers and their families, all trade unions in Europe and throughout the world?
The International Labor Organization, which works under its acronym ILO, is a specialized agency of the United Nations. I worked for the International Labor Organization, the ILO, in Turin, Italy. I was head of the United Nations Labor Education Program. The ILO's role is to set minimum labor standards for the world. So just as you would have in the United States, the Department of Labor setting minimum standards, like the $7 or $7.50 minimum wage and health and safety and other issues like that. So the ILO does that for the world. And what happens is that the ILO consists of governments, worker representatives, and an employer representatives. They get together every year and they adopt, or hopefully if they do their work at the convention correctly, they adopt standards that other countries can then adopt and make part of their law. And that's where I was working for 10 years.
All right, then. And I know you visit a lot of countries throughout the world. So, we got about 5 minutes left, and I want to get into a summary. And I have a couple questions here. I actually had three, but I'm going to skip one. But this is recent. Quote, unquote, make violence at work against international law, unquote. And the source was Radio Labor's World Report, September 1st through the 8th, 2019. Mark, could you explain this really serious issue? And beyond the U.S. and Canada, how prevalent is this type of violence throughout the world?
What you're referring to is ILO Convention 190.
Yes.
It was just adopted a few months ago, and now what has to happen is other countries have to adopt it. They have to put it into their law. The origins of this particular convention was the horrendous amount of violence against women in the workplace. And that's what this law particularly addresses itself to. So if you pass the law, for instance, if Canada and the United States passed the convention, it would adopt these new strictures into their national legislation. So it would help protect women in the workplace because they would have somewhere in the law to say this should not happen and I should be protected. And we are now just in the process of convincing countries to adopt ILO Convention 190.
That's great. But just to finish up there, Mark, where are some of the worst regions in the world for this type of workplace violence?
Oh, well, depends on what kind of violence you're talking about, but workplace violence is all over the world. It's in the United States. It's in Canada. It's based on misogyny. It's based on a hatred of women. It's based on young white men thinking that they're being somehow not helped by the fact that they're going to stop violence against women. It's a global problem. The worst place in the world for trade unionists, beyond just the question of Convention 190, is Colombia, where they actually kill unionists. You don't become a trade unionist in Colombia thinking you can get through it easily.
I had a radio show with some former missionaries that live here in Boulder who were down there, and they wanted to get an interview with me, and I gladly did it because they talked about working with trade union organizers down there, and incredibly enough, it was tough, but it was real. They told me that some of the ones they worked with,
did get murdered, killed. And thanks for bringing that up and letting people know that. Mark, I think we're going to maybe get this other question in here, and it's real quick. It's not self-serving for me or for you, but you talked about it a little bit earlier, just quickly. Labor radio. Why is labor radio very important for workers and their families, especially union members in the United States, Canada, and other countries throughout the world?
Well, obviously, the first point to mention is this, simply that there are union activists who want to hear more about the labor movement and learn about it. And that's how that's why your service is so important. When you do a program about the killings of trade unionists in Colombia or the violence of women in the United States, it's teaching people. It's an educational process. So I consider you to be both a broadcaster and a labor educator. The importance of labor of radio, in either internet-based or across the air-based radio stations, is that just because you are a unionist doesn't mean that you understand all of the arguments. You may say, I believe in the extension of collective bargaining to many, many more people, especially young workers in the gig economy. The gig economy is where they take jobs from places like Uber and such. That the trade unionist doesn't necessarily have the arguments to counter the company because they haven't heard it yet. But if they listen to radio like yours and my program, then they learn the arguments and they can then pass them on.
Mark, let's finish up with this. I mean, it's always I do this, and we got 1 minute. Do you have any final thoughts or comments for this KGNU listening audience in the context of tonight's subject, Radio Labor Canada, an update? And beyond that, how can anyone in this KGNU listening audience contact you to learn more about radio labor and get more informed about workers and their struggles to maintain and form unions throughout the world?
Let me answer the last one first. If you want to contact us, it's email@radiolabor.org. And by the way, the labor is spelled with a U. So it's radiolaborwithu.org. And we'll, of course, be happy to answer any of your questions. The other part about why it's important for radio to still exist is that radio in the United States for unions has almost disappeared. There are very few programs such as yours, and that's why your program is so important. It stands not only as a service to the people in your area, but as an example of what other people can do.
All right, then, Mark.
We could only get the funding for this.
Yeah, we're going to have a fall pledge drive, and we're going to push real hard. So I got to sum up and summarize here, but, you know, thank you for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU. And again, thank you for your ongoing support with my efforts here at KGNU. If anybody has any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, September 23rd, 2019, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been the Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio. Yep.